still here above crying, I can't breathe. Now I'm standing in struggle, singing, I can't leave. Quick on and out the violence of these racist police, and we ain't gonna stop it. Tell people to free. Said we ain't gonna stop it. Tell people to free. I still hear my brother crying, I can't breathe. And now I'm in a struggle, singing, I can't leave. We're calling out the violence of these racist police, and we ain't gonna stop till the people are free. Said we ain't gonna stop till the people are free.
And welcome to the Ferguson Response Network podcast. I am your host, Leslie Mack, and I'm joined as always by my co-host, Ricky. Hey, Ricky.
Hey, it's on you again.
Oh, that's good. You sound a little quiet.
Yeah, sorry about that. Is that better?
Okay. That's better. Yay.
All right.
Awesome. Okay. We have two amazing guests with us. First, we have Becca. Hey, Becca, how's it going?
Hey, everybody.
And we also have Leah Allen. How are you, Leah?
I'm doing wonderful.
Awesome. In case you are just joining us for the first time, the Ferguson Response Network podcast is a weekly podcast devoted to supporting citizens working to create a lasting social change through sustained civil disobedience and civic action. And you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Ferguson Response Network. And you can also find us on our website, FergusonResponse.org. And if you have actions that you are planning in your city, or you want to find what's going on in your local area, you can always go to FergusonResponse.tumblr.com. And as I mentioned, my co-host, Ricky L. Hines III, is with me as always. He's a Los Angeles.
Second, madam.
Oh, the second. Oh, sorry. I'm adding extra. You better get working on that one. He's a Los Angeles native, a U.S. Navy veteran, an avid Googler, a blogger, and he is founder of the Americans United Again movement. He hosts two other shows, the Americans United Again podcast, and he co-hosts with the lovely Sherelle, the AUA Hope podcast. And I'm always happy to have him here. He just
always
finished watching Selma, so we'll have to bear with him for a little bit. And then our two guests, and then we have Becca. She's a street medic. She's been a street medic for the last 12 years, loved to support people in action. She works to empower dissent by providing knowledge about the risks we take to our bodies and minds when we are out there. She's part of Firefly Action Medics and Mutual Aid Street Medics, and works as a registered nurse in Philadelphia and does some work with the Palestine Medical Relief Society in Ramallah. She's also helped start the People's Medical Relief, providing medical support in New York after Hurricane Sandy, and has started a few art studios for survivors of trauma since 2006, two in women's prisons in Massachusetts and one at a women's drop center in Kensington in Philadelphia. So welcome to Becca. We're so excited to have you here and to talk about all the important work that both street medics do and kind of give some information to those of us doing actions as to how we can keep ourselves safe out there.
Awesome. Yeah, looking forward to it.
Definitely. And Leah has been with us before, but Leah is a writer and human resource manager. She's also the co-founder of the Coalition Against Police Violence, CAPV, a group of diverse individuals and organizations fighting for racial and social equality in America's justice system. She resides in Atlanta, Georgia, and she is also the newest contributor to the AUA blog. Welcome back, Leah.
Yay! Glad to be back.
Yeah. Just at the top of the show, we played a version of the I Can't Breathe protest song by Justin the Beloved. You can find that on YouTube and it'll be in the show notes, or go to justinthebeloved.com. I've been playing different versions of the song every week, which has been fun. Although Ricky, he's not liking that part.
No, because I always feel bad. Like there's no way I can outdo that.
You don't have to, though, so it's okay. I have to search to find these really, really good ones. So there's a lot of just nice ones out there, but they're all great. So we usually start with some news. So why don't we jump into that, talk about a couple things. One was the Pittsburgh police chief responding to the Police Benevolent Association. And you heard about this chief before from Pittsburgh, right, Ricky?
Yeah, actually, we talked about it in episode 17, the last episode we did. This guy's awesome.
He's so awesome, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, just really focused on actually the big problem that people have with him is he had held up this sign that said, "I resolve to challenge racism at work, hashtag end white silence." And his name is Chief McLay. He's awesome. And, of course, the PBA got their bee in a bonnet wanting him to, guess what, apologize for saying he doesn't want the workplace to be racist. Hmm.
Doesn't, why does that require an apology? Let's just ask ourselves.
I don't understand. I'm so confused. What do you think, Leah?
You know, I'm not really surprised anymore because we're kind of living in this very, I don't want to call it apologetic, but essentially anyone that stands against white privilege or white supremacy is going to be expected to apologize for it. It's like, how dare you have a voice? How dare you try to call out what we know is an obvious threat against black life and really all life. I don't know what the exact word is for it, but I feel that sort of hypersensitivity. And when I saw it start, you know, not to take away from the police chief, but when I saw this happen in St. Louis with the Rams, mm-hmm. I was just really disgusted, you know, and the fact that you could get the police union and all of these folks involved to say, you owe us an apology, like we demand an apology. But here you have a police chief who understands common sense, who understands that there should not be racial bias or discrimination, especially in his field in law enforcement. To have to apologize for that is absolutely, I don't know, I guess for me it's just kind of expected. I don't know what the exact word is for it, but I'm pretty sure that anyone who's not a person of color who's on a major platform, especially as his position
right.
as a chief, is going to be expected to apologize for ever standing up against white silence.
It's kind of crazy. I love that he's because of course they call for him to apologize and he's like, yeah, I would do it again, which is my favorite part of the story because often you'll see somebody feel like they have to back down in that moment. And he's definitely kind of standing in the moment. He said to Katie Couric, did an interview with Katie Couric. He says, I think it was the right thing to do. He thinks that the right thing to do is to apologize. What he's basically saying is that there's not a perceived problem. There is a problem. It's not only within Pittsburgh. It's across the country. And he says he considers it a blessing and an opportunity because of some of the difficult issues surrounding this, the issues of race and policing. And the relationship between policing and our communities of color is an issue on the national forefront. So he sees this as kind of the first step for him to actually do the change that he was meant to do in Pittsburgh and in their police department. I will say one. Yeah, he is a really good guy. And funnily enough, I actually tweeted him originally when the first picture came out and he tweeted me back and said that he actually, this is his area of expertise, which is dealing with race and policing. And he was brought into Pittsburgh by the mayor to address this problem and for the specific purpose of doing what he's starting to do. So it's beyond just them asking him to apologize. He was like, they're asking me to apologize for the thing I got hired for. This is kind of crazy. It's nuts.
You can tell, Leslie, that he's so genuine because he kept talking, like you said, about it being a blessing and an opportunity to bring that issue to the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
So you can just tell that he's not just doing his job. Like, this is him as a person. This is everyday life.
Yep.
And he doesn't have any problem saying it. You know, the amazing thing, too, is his patience and how on that interview and speaking with Katie Couric, he said, you know, the only thing I would do different would be to also send out a message to his network and put everything in context. And the fact that he'd be willing to explain, this is why we have to end white silence.
Right.
This is why I agree with what this, you know, poster says. It just shows that he's also willing to kind of inform and address those people who just don't necessarily want to understand where he's coming from. They
right.
just want to pick it as, oh, he's race baiting and he's playing the race card, which Paul Mooney said, we don't even know where the debt came from, so you can't be pulling that race.
Exactly.
Exactly.
You don't, so, but I love his genuine, his he's very authentic.
Very. I want to go to Pittsburgh and just give him a big fat hug. Maybe I'll try that soon.
Definitely genuine. Here's the thing. He is, in fact, doing his job. He's focusing on a specific area like everyone focuses on. You know, you have narcotics officers. You have all types of different cops that have their specialties. His is ending the inherent racism in a police system.
Right.
And for unions to ask that he apologize, like, just think about what that means. That means that their feelings are more important than the conversation about white supremacy and why it's so detrimental to their own job, to the job that they're supposed to do.
Right. Like, he's there to make their job better, easier,
exactly.
More effective. That's the goal. Hello? Crazy. Well, anyways, shout out to you, Chief McClay. We like you. Dialogue Society named its word of the year, hashtag Black Lives Matter. They overwhelmingly voted to name Black Lives Matter its word of the year for 2014, marking the first time the group has chosen a Twitter hashtag in its annual vote. Quote, while Black Lives Matter may not fit the traditional definition of a word, it demonstrates how powerfully a hashtag can convey a succinct social message. Ben Zimmer, the chairman of the Society's New Words Committee, said in a statement, language scholars are paying attention to the innovative linguistic force of hashtags. What do you guys think about that?
I think there is a lot of power, and it's interesting that they've named it their word of the year.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the recent issue of Ebony Magazine is the first time they've never had an image. They're just using the words Black Lives Matter.
Right.
So the fact that, you know, it's a hashtag, it does stand alone on its own. I just don't want it to become something that is just a coin phrase that feels good and you throw it around when it feels right, and it really kind of loses, it gets watered down, so to speak. Hopefully that's not happening, but I do recognize, and I guess they recognize by adding it as the word of the year, they recognize its power and that it stands alone as well. I just hope that people really understand all that it really means when you say that, because it's a very all-encompassing statement, and it's a lot more than just three words.
Right. Ricky, what about you?
I think it's interesting. It's a good thing with regard to people understanding the movement, getting word about the movement out from a marketing perspective. I think that that's something that we really have to focus on is marketing, because like it or not, we kind of have to sell whatever we're asking to white people.
Mm-hmm.
We have no power. I always hate to say this and admit this, but the reality is that we are 12-14% of the population. And the only way that any change is going to happen is if majority of white people decide that it's going to happen, or we somehow get the right person in office with enough balls to stand up to the other majority, to the majority that has no problem with oppressing 12% of its population. So one of those things have to happen, and I think that it's always beneficial to shoot for both, you know. So from a marketing standpoint, this is excellent.
Absolutely. From my perspective, I took it two different ways. One is, I think it was a little bit on their part, a nod to the power of the hashtag and its, linguistic, necessity as a device to communicate in 2014. And obviously this was the biggest one hashtag of the year of last year. So it doesn't surprise me. It would have chosen that. Interestingly enough, hashtag was the word of the year in 2012. So that's interesting as well. But for me, the whole thing with Black Lives Matter, especially using it as a hashtag, I see it really as a much more than just a, rally call, because when you add the hashtag to it, it takes on a different level, because what happens then is that people are connecting through it. They are informing people about things using the hashtag. They're tagging things that you can always go back and know this is related to that. So to me, when you add the hashtag, it's not that it takes on a bigger meaning. It just takes a different meaning on, in that it starts to have a life that lives beyond just the meaning of the words as we might use them or say them or have them repeated back at an action or something like that. So I think it's interesting that they chose that. And of course, just with social media, it's not a surprise that they would eventually have to choose a hashtag, because certainly that's what we're all, that's like that Saturday Night Live joke where they talk in hashtags. I don't ever say hashtag.
Right.
You guys don't say hashtag, do you? Hashtag, no.
I used to.
Oh,
I used to. Just to be facetious.
First
be
the street honest. Harassment and now this. What are we going to do with you?
The thing about those words that I think when I hear them, though, is there's a big duality for it. And I've had moments where I hear those words being chanted or read them, and it's completely inspiring, and it's still celebratory. It's building a community. And then the other half of me is like, this is the most frustrating thing in the world to have to convince people of this.
Mm.
People should not have to be convinced of this. We should know that. And then the anger piece comes in, and it's all the same words.
It's so true. You hit that on the head.
Absolutely.
When you're doing it in an action, I've had that experience where we were in one area and we were saying it and it felt very, you know, it was building camaraderie and we were feeling all together. And then we were seeing it a little bit later, kind of walking through some cars. And this was a pretty large group, maybe 400 or so people here in Philadelphia. And I mean, I could hear the people thinking the N-word through the cars as we were saying it going by. And it just completely flipped my entire, like, personage.
Mm-hmm.
And just made it kind of crazy. And it was the same exact words. We all were chanting the same words, but they had such a different meaning in the context that they were being used. Both very powerful, but for sure I get that it can be a double-edged sword. Which actually is a good segue.
You know,
oh, go ahead, Leah.
Well, I just wanted to say, Leslie, that the thing that's very interesting, the dichotomy of this movement, is I was doing an action down in Macon not too long ago. And I don't know, you know, if listeners know much about Macon, Georgia, because I didn't know a lot about it. But it's a very small town.
Mm-hmm.
And but there's quite a few colleges and universities down there. It was very interesting because I think we had one sign that said Black Lives Matter, but we decided to stand on the bridge atop Interstate 75, and we could see all the people that were driving down from Georgia, getting ready to head into Florida or Alabama. And I made it a point the entire time I was there, I had my hands up with the hands up, don't shoot pose the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I counted like 9 times where I was flicked off, and I could even see some people driving past literally on the bridge. I could see people looking up as they're coming towards the bridge and like flicking me off or like giving me the sign, like they're putting their hand across their throat, like,
oh,
you know, kind of like yes to you.
Yeah.
But I wasn't saying anything.
Right.
So I didn't have any words that said Black Lives Matter. So just the power of symbols and images and words in this movement is pretty incredible to me. But Black Lives Matter, I've said, you know, publicly to people that know me and maybe some people that don't, it can and it has to stand on its own, and it should not need explanation. It's not like we say Black Lives Matter and nobody else does.
Exactly.
Right.
At the action we were at today, we were saying Black Lives Matter, and a white woman was walking into the building, and she actually turned around and said, White Lives Matter, and then Drew lost his shit.
Oh, wow.
Oh, well then. Wow.
Angry white guy.
Yeah, he was pretty angry.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, anyways, I was saying it's a good segue as we were talking about kind of during actions, how your personage can change so quickly. So let's do a quick segue and go into kind of the safety and health and the movement segment. And I know it's something we've been covering just because, you know, sustainability and self-care and making sure that we're as healthy as we can be in this work is so important to building a sustainable movement. So, Becca, I know first I just want to ask how the training went. Becca did a training with Polly, correct? Yeah, a couple of nights ago here in Philadelphia. I heard it went really well. Talk a little bit about how that came to be and kind of what you guys were doing there.
Yeah, it was a small and mighty group. It was a lovely group. It came together. Basically, I went to one of the meetings at Cavalry, and I had written a health and safety training, and that was about 40 minutes long. And I was hoping to connect with people there, and that's exactly what happened. And I met with Ari and a few other people, and we blended some street medic stuff that we've been doing for years, that just is kind of tried and true, how to stay empowered and safe, with some explicitly named healing justice work. And that stuff's always been part of street medic health and safety, but including like explicitly named healing justice work into that. We were trying to really focus on the I was going to say self-preservation, but that sort of doesn't have the right connotation.
Mm-hmm.
But making sure that people feel empowered, that they're in control of the risks that they're taking, that our bodies and our minds are protected when we're out there. And that doesn't mean passivity. It just means being in control of the risks that you take and knowing those risks, which empowers people to go out more, stay out in the street longer, and to get involved in other ways that are best for where people are at. And that's sort of what the training was about. It was a lot of really practical skills, like signs of hypothermia. We did training on how to deal with chemical weapons and handcuff injuries, really concrete stuff. We also did a group meditation. We talked about grounding techniques and a lot of things in between.
Awesome. And what would you say is kind of the number one either immediate injury or prolonged injury or safety issue that you see when people are doing protests on a consistent basis?
This time of year, people are too cold.
Mm.
People are getting mild hypothermia. People are risking more severe hypothermia.
Mm.
That would be definite for this type of year in Philly. We don't see a lot of chemical weapons here.
Right.
But I know that in other cities, people are facing pepper spray, facing tear gas. People are figuring out how to deal with that on their own, and you know we have a lot of information about what the best way to handle that is.
And as a street medic, had you before this kind of movement kicked off done a lot of work with protesters, or was this your first interaction with assisting
no,
with
this
protesters?
This is something I've been doing for about 12, 13 years. It just feels like it feels like a really comfortable role when there's a sort of an upsurge of action for any particular issue.
Mm-hmm.
I have my own that are really important to me, of course, but this is a way that I just love supporting people. People are so brave. People put themselves out there again and again, and I just want to support that, help people stay out there as long as they can and empower autonomy at every step of the way. So that's a lot of what street medics tend to do.
That's awesome. Ricky, did you have any questions about safety in action? I know you don't go out too much because we don't know what you get yourself into.
Again, I'm sorry that Selma just threw me off.
I know.
Never watched Selma right before you.
I told you not to do that.
Yeah. Oh, that hurt. But I think what she said was very telling in and of itself, simply because of the fact that people are actually braving these things to do what's right. And so, you know, it's extremely helpful to have someone like her present there because, you know, they're not doctors. They don't know what's going on. They may be feeling something, but this is for them life or death. Because it could be any one of us.
Right. Absolutely. And Leah, I know you've gone to a bunch of actions. Have you seen any issues that came up with safety or any issues that you thought could happen. I know a lot of actions going on this weekend and certainly on Monday in particular for Martin Luther King Day.
I honestly am super excited about the actions that I've been seeing. And in terms of concerns, maybe like around safety or having some disruption, I feel that at least the Atlanta community right now, we're at a point where we are just digging into understanding for ourselves how is Ferguson Atlanta? How is Ferguson really everywhere? And I think right now, just speaking for myself and a lot of the other activists and organizers, young and old, that I've talked to, are really in a place of, like I said, digesting that and making it personal. But also, we've gotten a little bit over the rage and the frustration of what happened in, the Darren Wilson trial and Daniel Pantaleo, and not seeing justice there. So I think that phase of it is over. I think right now there's just a renewed focus on what is it really going to take to bring about real change. And I'm starting to see a little bit of this, just people coming together, lots of different groups and organizations, to say we may not agree on the same things, but we understand how we're going to get there, and a lot more support on activism from a street level. So what's happening on the ground and the protests and everything there. And I tell you, I've seen some actions and been a part of some actions that are really, I would call radical, and people are getting a lot more creative in the ways that they're doing things. And that really excites me as well. But it is emotionally coming to a place where we can come together and really dig deep into the issue and have great dialogue and conversation, and also say, how do we work better together? Because we understand that this is not just a one-time case, that Ferguson is in Atlanta, that there are so many cases that we've heard about that we may not necessarily, or in so many cases that we haven't heard about, that we need to bring to the forefront and have those conversations as well. But a lot of support being thrown around some of the actions that are taking place on the ground. So that it gets me really excited, and I'm really excited as well about how MLK's dream is kind of being reframed, and we're kind of calling into question, what do we really understand about Martin Luther King Jr. and his dream? And so I'm so excited for this weekend. I really am.
Yeah, it's going to be really awesome. Becca, one thing that I know, and this is just a sign of the times, is that a lot of people participating in the actions right now, this may be their first time ever protesting in their lifetime. So they don't come to the table with a lot of even common sense knowledge about protesting, because it really wasn't something that, you know, was in the vernacular of skill sets that you pick up in middle school when we were in school. You know what I mean? So why don't, if you don't mind, just talk a little bit about kind of, for a first-time protester, what they should be expecting and what things they should be cautious of or prepare themselves for that maybe they wouldn't think of because you wouldn't know until you've done it.
Absolutely, yeah. And the fact that there's so many new folks out there is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And the number one thing to bring with you when you go out in the street, the number one thing is to bring a buddy. You got to bring somebody with you who's got your back, somebody who's got similar goals for the day that you have. That person may or may not be your best friend, because you might have different goals that day. Some people have obligations. They can't stay out until 4 in the morning doing whatever, risking arrest, and other people can. So finding that person that you trust when you're feeling vulnerable, that you can talk to about what makes you feel anxious, what sets you off, and also to talk to that person about what do you want them to do when you feel that way. Do you need to be left alone? Do you need to go scream it out? What do you need? But people get, this is emotionally charged work that we're taking on. It's not just physically hard. Mm-hmm. You've got to have somebody with you who's got your back. So when you're getting all hyped up and dealing with something, you've got danger coming at you from one side. You have to have somebody who's looking over your shoulder. So I would say finding a buddy who shares your goals that you trust is the number one thing to bring with you out there. Yeah.
Excellent. That's really great. And I don't think that's something anybody would necessarily think about. And especially having those conversations before you go to the action. which is really critical.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, there's a whole lot of information that we can give. And I looked at the links that you posted, Leslie, and I think that over the next week or so, maybe the at least me and some of the other folks I work with can maybe flesh them out a little bit. Because they have great information for folks that are new, especially about at least what we call street ops, sort of like how crowds move in a street at a protest, what to look out for, things like always having three exits, you know, sort of how do cops move, what's the deal. And there's great information in those about that. There's not a lot of information in there about, like, specific health and safety.
Right.
And one of the things that I wanted to definitely mention about focusing on safety and focusing on grounding and focusing on staying focused is that it's not about passivity. Staying safe and in action doesn't mean that you're passive. It just means that you're focused and that you're as in control of your risks as you want to be. So one of the other big things that you can bring out with you is a grounding tactic. And we talk about grounding as feeling calm in the chaos and feeling focused. So again, it's not about being passive. You can be angry. You can be doing whatever that looks like for you, but you are focused in it. And for some people, that means having a person with them. Other people, that means if you start to feel yourself getting up there and you're not thinking clearly, you know, pop in a piece of gum. Take a sip of your water. Have a snack. Some people like to bring grounding herbs with them. There's some easy do-no-harm ones like lavender. That's a really calming herb that people like to bring out with them to just have a nice scent in the air. There's a lot of other things that people can do, but taking some deep breaths and physically feeling the ground beneath your feet and feeling centered so that when you're out there and you're active, you're focused and you'll remember every bit of it as opposed to being carried away in a way that you don't want to be.
My mind just got blown a little bit right there. Just this idea of grounding in action really is just astounding and huge. Ricky, only because I know we've talked before about, you know, your hesitance to go to these actions because of that. What are your thoughts?
Honestly, to this point, I'm glad that I haven't gone because I didn't give any thoughts to anything that she said prior to this. Not I had actually, every time that I've started to go to a protest, it's been me alone. Mm-hmm. It's been, you know, I haven't been given any thoughts to any of these types of things because this isn't something that you think to prepare for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this kind of hit, this entire movement kind of took everyone by storm. And I mean, I think for a lot of us, it takes us having to adjust, and not all of us adjust at the same thing at the same rate.
Absolutely, so
I am. Becca, I owe you one.
Well, Ricky, you made me think of something really important that I wanted to mention, which is that the work that we're all doing is not just about being in the street, because not everybody can go out in the street. There's a lot of work that people can do that is being done that doesn't have anything to do with being in the street. And that's a really important thing to remember. There's people who can't go out, who can't risk arrest, who physically can't make those marches, but who are doing incredible work. And a lot of this movement building, and I imagine any movement, is about finding a niche, something you're good at, there's a hole there, and filling it in. And I think people think more creatively about what they can do, and then they end up being busier and doing more when they're not doing what everybody's doing, which is going out in the street. So that's one role, and there's lots of other roles. And for people that have those struggles that don't put them out in the street, or they just have the opinion that that's not where they want to be, which I share sometimes for sure, that's fine. There's other things to do that are super important, and that's part of the longevity of these sorts of things, is finding something that you can do that's sustainable, that's within your scope, that's within your personal boundaries, that's something you get excited about.
Absolutely.
That's also an important thing, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And it actually goes back to what Leah was talking about, which is kind of the age of the protest or movement society within each of our local areas. You know, they've been protesting in Ferguson for 156 days or something like that. So you learn a lot in 156 days, and I'm sure that a lot of us now in cities that didn't get to the level where there's constant action until later, we're just now coming to this conclusion of, okay, now we've got to figure out how to make this work into our lives. We have to figure out how to ensure that this is something that's going to be consistent. And how, what does that look like for this city or this area? And it's a very different than reactionary in terms of, okay, something's popped off and we've got to react to it. This is a very different type of movement that we're going to see in this year of resistance. It's going to be a lot more planned. It's going to be, as Becca said, a lot more focused. And it's going to be a lot more purposeful, which is a very different kind of action. And I also think that we get a lot less, shall I say, leeway from both the authorities and from the general public in these types of actions that we're going to be doing this year, because I think that there's a level of understanding, like something terrible has happened to the community, and so we're reacting to it, and there's almost this idea of, well, let them blow off their steam or whatever. But this is something else.
I don't know that we got that, though. I don't know that people ever got that.
Well, they didn't in Ferguson for sure at all. But
yeah, I mean, it's so strange that most people, as they like, and this is what drives me mad, is are the people, are the moderates who say things like, I don't see color. Okay, fine, you don't see color. So let's just imagine this group of American citizens here decided they were upset about the extrajudicial execution of an 18-year-old teenager, and they go out to protest, and they're tear gassed, and they have rubber bullets shot at them, and the police department looks like a paramilitary force. How would you feel about that? It's like, oh, I'd be appalled. Then why weren't you?
Right.
You stood by and let this happen. Whenever these types of things happen in a society this large, it is the will of the people.
Mm-hmm. But only
we have to ask ourselves what that says.
What'd you say, Leah?
I think that's what makes people uncomfortable, because it's the will of the people who are deemed worthy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think you have Black Lives Matter, because you have a group of people who said enough is enough. We want to be treated like human beings. And when we die, if we must die, we want there to be some justice in our death. And so, like you said, Ricky, it's absolutely the will of the people. And for people that say that they don't see color, well, we know they're lying to themselves, but it's just a matter of I don't see color because I don't feel it. I don't see oppression around me. It doesn't affect me. So, therefore, I don't see it and it doesn't exist. Just because you don't see something does not mean it doesn't exist. And I think time and time again, we've seen that, not just in Ferguson, but in a lot of different instances.
Absolutely. So, Becca.
Yeah, well, it's a matter of perception and position.
Right.
You know, if I'm standing on the outside of a house, I can't see whether or not anyone's inside of it. But the second I walk in, I can see that. It's just
exactly.
Absolutely.
So if you have this door and I'm inside the house and I tell you, hey, there's no one else in here, you should probably take my word for it. Because you can't come through the door. You can't be Black. Nor would you want to be.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be the challenge for this movement. Mm-hmm. I think that'll be a huge step forward if we can use 2015 with that perspective and that lens, because allies are important, and the Black Lives Matter movement needs non-Black people to make it sustainable and to make it impactful. But that, I think, is while it's just as much a challenge to the folks who refuse to see color or think that they don't see color. When people say that, I guess they're saying they don't have a bias bone in their body, which is impossible. But it's also a challenge to us as we're in the struggle to really figure out how do we continue to unify and how do we build alliances and how do we remind ourselves that we can all be privileged, whether we're Black, white, gay, straight, able-bodied. There's always a privilege and always a bias there. How do we learn to acknowledge that those are there, and then that, like you said, Ricky, just because you don't necessarily see it, there's still an impact. It still affects someone. and those things are all created. This system that we keep talking about, systemic injustice, is not a one-sided, one characteristic system. It is comprised of so many different things, and I think if we can build on that in 2015, we're going to see a lot of momentum.
Absolutely. Becca, one other thing I wanted to ask you was, I know there's lots of different types of actions, and this is, I'm talking about physical actions that people are going to go to or participate or plan. And I would imagine that there's some different techniques, tactics, or information you think people should know when they're going to a very large action, let's say 100 or more people, or something small, which would be under 20 people. What are the big differences between those two and the approach that you think protesters should be going into those two types of situations with as a protester preparing to go?
Stop me if I'm not getting the point of your question, but I would say for something small, that's sort of like what can sometimes be seen as like what's called an affinity group. So meaning that people have a shared goal and they all kind of know each other. If there's only 20 or so people there, you have an opportunity to like take a minute and get to know everybody's name, what they're there for, just a little bit about them, what sets some people off. Just sort of get to know everybody. There's only 20 of you there if you can take a minute to do that. And that builds a pretty tight community. A larger protest, 100 or more, you're not really sure what's going on, and there might be multiple messages, people with multiple goals. Things might get split off at certain points, and people end up, I mean, amazing things happen at those, at both kind of actions. I mean, a lot of what happens that you see that's covered in the media is the general message, the general tone, and then some of, like, the big hot stuff that media likes to cover, both independently and any kind of media, you know? But the stuff that you don't really see is the relationship being built and the networking that happens and the personal growth that happens for each person when they're either watching it or participating in it. And that's something that you can expect at any size action. It's just, it might be a more variety, you know, varied experience at a larger one. Was that sort of what you were asking?
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. Just kind of that you want to... try and get to know people. And it's true, you do kind of create a separate space when you're doing actions. It's almost a microcosm, family-ish kind of atmosphere in terms of, you know, you all have to decide what's going to happen next. Sometimes it's not quite as planned as you might think. There's a lot of improvisation that happens. So I always like to let, if they haven't gone to actions, to know that, you know, you can't always know what everything that's going to happen beforehand, because a lot of things just kind of change based on what's going on, the weather, the way the police are acting, what streets are blocked off. You never know what you're going to kind of run into. So to always be prepared.
Definitely. And as far as being prepared for all of those things and being prepared, bringing food with you, even though you're in the middle of the city, bringing water with you, even though you're in the middle of the city, stop to pee any chance you get. You don't know when the next chance will be. Making sure you have enough layers, making sure you know how to dress properly for the weather, and then bring extra stuff with you. If you take, this is one important point, if somebody takes medications that they need to take every day, you got to bring them with you in their original prescription bottle. That way, if for some reason you're arrested and you have your medication with the original prescription, legally you're supposed to be given that medication while you're in jail. The other thing that I'll just throw in there that's pretty practical advice, not everywhere that they're doing these actions have legal collectives that are supporting them, which is an amazing, amazing resource for those of us that have it. But whether you have it or you don't, preparing a legal form before you go, or just that in case I don't, you know, in case I get lost in the sauce form, you know, if you stay out later than expected, who to call in case you're arrested, what to tell them, do you take any medications? And anything, you know, if you want people to know your legal name and your birthday, and give that to somebody who's not at the protest and who's not arrestable, and then you get your one phone call, you call that person, they can advocate for your medical needs, they can take care of the logistics that you might not be able to take care of, and that might be able to help ease your mind so you can focus on the action itself.
Excellent.
Being that person is another really important role that people who can't go out in the street can take.
That's great. Wow. honestly, so much of this stuff is like completely revelatory for me that you're talking about, Becca, because it's putting me in a place of really approaching actions that I might go to in a much more business-like manner. And I know that when I'm there, I get to have the emotion of it because it is emotional. But I think that it would be really grounding knowing I had thought about all of these things ahead of time and I'm prepared and really, you know, armed, so to speak, not literally, but figuratively, with everything that I need to be successful and be focused during the action. So thank you so much for being here and giving all of that information. And as soon as you guys have that document together, we'll definitely share it with everybody. Leah or Ricky, did you guys have specific questions for Becky surrounding safety, health, especially as we head into a lot of actions this weekend and on Monday? Anything that you guys have heard?
I have a question with regard to what are the warning signs that something that you need to move?
Like cop wise?
Basically cop wise.
Yeah. I mean, like you can be near like a huge crowd of cops in full riot gear, but you just read their body language. If they're chilling, you can chill. If they're starting to put their gear on and they're starting to form up, and you might want to look, that's when you need to start looking for your exit and figuring out what your goal is in that moment. From my experience, most cops in formation, they don't make independent decisions. They're following orders. It's a complete bureaucracy. So look for those white shirts. Look for folks calling out orders. You can sort of see how they move. It's a good idea to do that while you're there all the time. Keep looking 360 all the time. Check in with folks. I mean, you might see a clear path ahead of you and forget to turn around and they formed up behind you.
Mm.
They often, if in a city, they often form up not necessarily on the block you're on, but right, a block sort of parallel to you, maybe on either side. So if you have scouts that are sort of running the perimeter of where people are at, especially if they're holding space for a long time, you can sort of have some folks run around and really, one really important thing is if somebody says something like the cops, the first thing you ask them is, where did you get that information?
Hmm.
You got to do some really important, really tight rumor control when you're out there, because they're, especially with all of the live feeds and social media, all this stuff, there's people getting information from all over the place. So you got to know the source. If somebody comes at you with some potentially very important information, like there's a paddy wagon two blocks away, or, you know, they're doing this, that, and the other thing, ask that person where you get that information. If they saw it with their own eyes, that's different than if there's somebody told them or they saw it on live stream or something.
Right.
Yeah. And also looking out for what cops are carrying. You see cops with a whole bunch of flexi cuffs. That's very different than if they don't have those. You can sort of get to know how pepper spray is deployed, how tear gas is deployed, and then some of the other weapons that they use, and you can see them. And if you see them on that cop, then if you see them on cops, then you know that that's a potential possibility. When we do longer street medic trainings or we do health and safeties, we often show pictures and show people this stuff for the purpose of dispelling that fear, because the whole point of in a protest situation, not all the time, and I don't want to start a whole debate right now necessarily, it's not on the agenda, but the point of that is fear and the threat of violence and sometimes real violence. And the point of that is to dispel, to squash our ability and our desire to be out there. So if we're aware of what we're going into, we can dispel some of that fear and have a lot more knowledge when we're out there. So it's intentional.
Awesome. Leah, did you have anything to add?
I did not. I've just been taking it all in. Becca made some really good points that are just hitting home for me, both as, you know, an organizer as well as somebody that just attends actions. And I've just taken notes and taking it in. It really has put things into perspective for me in terms of the importance of being grounded. And, you know, because I think that'll all kind of play out too in terms of safety, and you can't necessarily prevent people that may be disruptive or just want to be disruptive, even if you have the most peaceful, you know, nonviolent action or protest planned, but what we can control is ourselves. And, you know, I'm a person that meditates and I pray, and I never really kind of tied that part of it in to the actual work. I tie it more so ideologically and philosophically, but in terms of just being present at actions, what do I do to prepare myself mentally, emotionally, and then how do I make sure that I've got the right people around me to make sure that I'm safe and that everyone's safe, and just different things to think about. It's really been helpful for me. So I'm just taking notes. I'm loving it.
It's awesome. I'm so excited. I can't thank you enough, Becca. I know you're sticking around, but I just wanted to say thanks immediately for all of this information, because I think it's going to give people a lot to think about as they go into this weekend. As I said, a big protest weekend, and hopefully be as safe as they possibly can while they're out there on the streets or not on the streets, because I do think that there's a level of anxiety that comes with doing a lot of the work that's not outside as well, and it's isolating, so you have to kind of ground yourself and make sure you're staying connected as well, just for sanity's sake sometimes.
Yeah, and I mean, I can't stress how important the information that you were able to provide is. Just given the fact that, to the best of my knowledge and Leslie's knowledge, it's the only podcast devoted directly to the Black Lives Matter movement. And even though I don't go out and protest, I do have a few interactions with some of the local protesters in the area, and this is one of the things that, honestly, they could definitely use, especially like Black Lives Matter, Long Beach and L.A., just to be able to share with new people before they go out. Because, as I said, I would have been one of those new people, and I would have been completely unprepared. And I think a lot of people go into these things unprepared, and I think that the knowledge that you bestowed upon upon us helps us to educate them and make this a lot more powerful of a movement.
Mm-hmm. And sustainable as well, which is so huge, because we know this is not going to be a short-term situation. And I think that's part of the realization, Lee, that you were mentioning in Atlanta, is that you know the city and the communities, you see the organizations coming together, because it has started to sink in, like, oh, this is something we're going to have to continue to do. Well, we better figure out the best way to do this. We better figure out how to pool our resources. We better figure out who's going to work best in which areas. We better figure out what common ground we have, because otherwise we don't stand a chance of sustainability. And the town hall meeting that Becca mentioned, that she was able to connect with people to put the training here in Philadelphia together, is just that. We've had four of them so far. We have another one coming up January 20th, and it's people from so many different organizations. There's a collective that does babysitting for during action, so that parents are able to go. Street medics. There's obviously people from the religious community. We have pacifists. We have so many different organizations that have been able to come together under this umbrella of the Black Lives Matter movement, and really in a different way than I think I've ever seen in my lifetime, just coming to the table, not to say with their tail between their legs, because that's not what I mean, but humble in the work, which makes it so much easier for them to connect, even if they don't agree about everything all the time.
Absolutely.
One of the things that's been really cool to see is people that are either just new to this kind of work, thinking things up out of necessity that have been thought up before, which is really cool. That is really cool and really validating. There's a lot, like, people are inventing things that are just out of necessity because they make sense and they've already been done and tried and true. Those folks just don't know it yet. And it's really unifying and it's really validating. And it shows that what people are thinking of is really sustainable and is really well thought out in a lot of ways. Some of that stuff that is being replicated. That's really cool to see. I really like seeing that.
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons why I started the Ferguson Response Tumble in the first place, was to just give a good picture and show people that this is not just in one city, that this is a movement that unites all of us, even though it may look different in Oklahoma than it does in Arizona or New York City versus Miami. It's still the fight that we're all in together. So that has been really nice to see. I actually had a situation this week, speaking of safety and legal, as part of the 4 Mile March, which Leah is, Lee, you're an organizer for the one in Atlanta, correct?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. What is it up to, 28 cities now, I think, or 29? I know there was a bunch that got added today.
Yes, I think we're at 29 cities officially. So
it's amazing.
It's wow. Kind of incredible.
It's so, so cool. I'm so excited about all of the cities having. We're having a big march here in Philadelphia, and it's part of the 4 Mile March network as well. And there are a pair of organizers who are holding a 4 Mile March in Alabama, in Florence, Alabama. And so they had started putting together their event and started, you know, doing the regular stuff, getting a Facebook page, marketing stuff. And they started just getting met with clergy saying, nope, we're not going to participate. They couldn't get any lawyers or legal organizations to come and be legal observers at the event. And they would ask why. And they were told, well, we're afraid. Apparently 2 years ago in a nearby town called Russellville, Alabama, they had a large Mexican population that moved into the area, into the city, and the local law enforcement, according to news reports, called in the Klan to hold a rally to deal with the quote Mexican problem in Russellville in 2012. And it worked. A lot of the people of Mexican descent there just left the town. And since then, there's been a really strong fear from people in the area. They just don't want to rock the boat. And so even clergy, lawyers, pretty much even people that wanted to just come to the march were just really leery of going. And they were a little bit concerned, not for their safety, because they really didn't think anything was going to happen, but concerned for the success of the march, because, you know, they want to make sure people feel safe and that they know that nothing's going to happen. So a bunch of us other organizers were chatting about it on Facebook. And I said, well, let me see what I can do. I can reach out to a few people that I know. And I pinged like the ACLU and a couple of other people up against the law collective, who provided a couple of contacts. And then sometimes I do crazy stuff, and I actually DM'd Jesse Williams from Grey's Anatomy. And I said, hey, Jesse, I've got these two organizers in Alabama. They're trying to hold this event. So I kind of briefly explained what was going on. And he said, all right, give me a little while. I'll get somebody for you. And he found a lawyer in Alabama and got me their contact information. And they are going to be providing legal support for this march now on Monday. So,
wow.
It's kind of crazy. It's totally nuts and completely amazing. I mean, he's fantastic, generally speaking, but I didn't expect him to. I thought he was just going to like tweet about it for me because he has a lot of followers. That was my initial thought process on what he could do. I thought he could maybe just, you know, tweet it and somebody would see it because he has so many followers, and that way I'd get somebody. I never ever thought he was going to personally find somebody and get them taken care of and squared away. It's kind of crazy and amazing and awesome. So I just wanted to mention that quick story because it happened this week, and that is going to be in Florence, Alabama at Wilson Park, 11 a.m. Monday, January 19th. Yeah, this is kind of nuts. So yeah, Ricky, what do you do on Monday? You going somewhere?
I'm thinking about it, but the answer is probably no. Simply because, one, I don't want to go by myself. That
right.
would be,
that's
especially
no
after learning from Becca, that would be a right. terrible idea. Sherelle can't go just because of her back, so it not the best idea for me to go anywhere. But I do want to make sure that I keep an eye on what's going on so that I'm able to better report what's going on.
For
because
sure.
that's been a really... That's going to be really important, to be quite honest. And I'm sure we'll kind of cover that when we start discussing Selma. Because me and you talked about this in the pre-show.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the one thing that we lost, or the biggest difference between then and now, is one, of course, we've learned a lot of lessons, but two, there was an objective and honest media
mm-hmm.
platform,
yep.
and it was a mass media platform, and there was no Fox News. You
right.
had no place to just get your own facts like you have now.
Mm-hmm.
So this is going to have to be a long run. This is going to have to be something that takes a while.
Absolutely. Well, that's a good segue, as good a segue as any, to jump into Selma. Becca and Leah, have you guys seen the movie yet? Yes or no?
I haven't, and I'm actually going to hop off and listen to the segment when it's aired, because I wake up really early for work.
You got it. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for being here.
It was a pleasure chatting with all of you.
Thanks, Becca.
Same
here. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Bye.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
So that was part one of our episode 5. We actually split this into two because the rest of the discussion, which starts off with Selma and goes into some general thoughts about the movement and where we go from here, ended up running a bit longer than originally anticipated. But the discussion was so great, we wanted to make sure everybody heard it. So that's the end of this first part. And again, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Ferguson Response Network, and you can find us on our website, FergusonResponse.org. And if you have actions that you're planning, or if you're looking for an action in your area, please be sure to visit FergusonResponse.tumblr.com. Thanks, and have a good night.